Today, the bliss of ignorance.
Welcome to Coffee with Creamer, where you get to sit down with our host, Dr. Barry Creamer, for a conversation about faith, life, and culture. We'll look at old ideas through a new lens, turn those culture wars on their head, and paint a picture of the way things could be. If you like your thinking deep and your coffee hot, pull up a chair. You're in the right place.
I do enjoy that expression, by the way, ignorance is bliss, because I remember an old preacher, and he's passed away now, long ago, decades ago he passed away, but when I was younger and enjoyed a more combative approach to everything, to everything, I remember him using the expression with someone, you know, if ignorance is bliss, you're a blizzard. It really stuck since then. So I've always clung to the expression, ignorance is bliss. There is in it, obviously, some irony. I mean, the object of it is to say, once you start learning things, you become cynical and things get darker and you know things you wish you didn't know. And there are all kinds of negatives to knowing things. And so there is a bliss, a blind happiness that goes with not knowing things, with ignorance. So that's obviously where the expression is coming from. And I have learned over the years, over the decades, a few things about this. And we are sharing today, just in a practical sense, and from an academician, a person who's been in higher ed for a lot of decades now, the importance of knowledge and a way we ought to think about ourselves in relation to that knowledge. It's a practical lesson that I think almost any adult is aware of, and yet not very many of us really live in the knowledge that I want to talk about today. So where it really hit home for me or started for me, just beginning to grasp this concept was when I was an early professor, very early in my academic career. I had been pastoring for 20 years already at the time and was finishing my PhD and had an opportunity to go and serve at Texas Woman's University, or at least interview at Texas Woman's University for a position they needed filled for someone to teach philosophy. And so I was finishing a PhD in humanities in the areas of philosophy and history, and it went well, and I enjoyed my PhD, and I learned a tremendous amount. And truthfully, I didn't really study philosophy, and I say really, I can take the really out of that. I just simply did not study philosophy until I was in my PhD. I didn't have any philosophy classes before that. So I was just a sponge soaking it up, because once I took a philosophy class, I realized that's where all the interesting things were, at least the things I'd always been interested in. That's where they were. That's where people talked about them. So, I took to it like a duck to water. I was all over it. Now, there's a background to this that I guess I should give you before I get to talking at TWU, having an interview at TWU. And that is, and this is not all autobiographical by any stretch of the imagination. I just want to give you the background for when this became real to me as an issue. My background before that in ministry and in scripture and around the people that I knew who were in ministry built a really high level of confidence. I'm trying to avoid the word arrogance in me. I don't know why I'm avoiding it, because it would still be an accurate description. I started reading the Bible all the time when I was young, and read it through high school, and attended every worship service that I could attend, and listened to every sermon I could listen to, and I memorized sermons. And I was fortunate as a young person that I could memorize things really easily, and so I would memorize chapters or books at a time, and it was, compelling for me to learn those things. And so as I read the Bible over and over and over again, I got to a point where, although I never ever in my life learned to quote things chapter and verse, I did learn to quote things and to know what chapter they were in. And then I could figure out where it was in the chapter. You know, it's two-thirds of the way down. It's right after this section and so on. And so I, you know, my it appeared to people, and I don't mean this about everybody, that everybody would have evaluated it this way, but it sort of looked this way, that I had an encyclopedic knowledge of Scripture. You know, it's not quite accurate, but I, you know, I knew enough that if people asked a question, I could say, well, you know, in 2 Corinthians 10, it says blah, blah, blah. And I would show them the verse. And, you know, it was just from an early age, something that was surprising to people how much I knew. So that's, you know, that's what I thought of myself. Oh, I'm the guy that knows things. I'm aware of that. I know how to answer questions and so on like that. And so confidence never lacked. You know, combine that with debate and public speaking all the time. And yeah, arrogant probably is the right word to use for my youth, right? So anyway, I had all of that. So then I get this, I pastor for a long time, and there's a lot of humility that comes with pastoring because you learn how many things you don't know how to do and such. And so I'd done that for a while, but I'd also been working on a PhD. And when I got to the end of my PhD, before I quite finished, I was invited to come up for an interview at Texas Woman's University and talk about potentially being a philosophy professor. And I was really intimidated because I was going to meet with a professor of philosophy who was in his 70s and preparing to retire and knew everything, obviously, about philosophy. And I just, you know, I was still fairly, even though I was getting a PhD in including that discipline, you know, there's just a lot of things I didn't know. I never really focused on 20th century philosophers at all. So when people started talking about Searle or other philosophers, I just sort of nodded and said, yeah, probably so, you know. And so I was a little nervous. So I crammed. Here I am cramming for an interview by reading Wikipedia. It wasn't Wikipedia at the time. It wasn't actually available. But it was that kind of stuff, you know. But just, you know, just superficial knowledge about the every name in 20th century philosophy I could find. And I knew the Enlightenment stuff pretty well, and I was pretty comfortable with classics. And because of my theological background, I had a pretty good knowledge of the Middle Ages and those kinds of things more than others. So I didn't feel uncomfortable with those, but I was cramming for 20th century knowledge to justify to this person that I was going to interview with a PhD that I was actually earning at the University of Texas at Arlington in the humanities, including in the area of philosophy. So as I'm cramming for all of that, I realized how insecure I was, but also how much I actually did not know, which was, I wasn't used to that, not at all. By the way, the interview went great, and we talked about the things I actually did know, and things were, you know, all fine. And I really enjoyed that gentleman. Jack Sibley was his name, and he's passed away since then. Really fine, fine man. Anyway, and had a great experience all the years that I got to teach at Texas Woman's University. Great, great institution. Then, so I got the position, got the opportunity to teach adjunct professor of philosophy. They didn't have any full-time they didn't have a program in philosophy, so they just had philosophy classes that needed to be taught. So they mostly just needed an adjunct at the time. So I was an adjunct, but I taught several classes for them every semester. Had a great time doing it. So I start getting ready to teach my first classes in philosophy, introduction to philosophy and things like that. And it was, you know, I don't know, three or four classes, ethics and bioethics and something else. And I'm starting to teach the classes. I realized before every class, I needed to read everything that could be read about what I was going to be covering that class session, because there were just so many things I didn't know about the details of what I wanted to share with the students. I knew the broad swaths of what to talk about. The broad strokes, I guess I should say, of what to talk about. I just didn't know the details. And so I was just cramming for knowledge that, again, I had a PhD in the discipline and was a little insecure about all of the things that I did not know that I needed to teach in those classes. And I did that for years when I first started teaching at Criswell College and taught the Greek world or other courses like that. I did the same thing. I was trying to grasp things that I didn't really have that great a knowledge of, before I would walk into a class and then act as if I knew it to students. It was really disconcerting until I got a little experience and learned one simple lesson that changed the whole way I think about doing everything I do now. And so for the rest of my ministry and academic career, I've learned this reality about how we serve. I learned, this is so dumb. You would think, how could you not have known this? But I'm telling you, I've given the advice to, I have no idea how many people, and it always matters. And what I learned was simply this: teach what you know. Don't try to teach the stuff you don't know. Don't try to act like you're someone you're not. And so having learned over a course of years of teaching in higher ed, to do that, to teach what I know, I began to realize sort of what was going on in my own experience. And a part of what was going on was, you know, pride and a desire to compare myself with other people and act as if I were just as in the know as they were about the things they knew, instead of being able to say, well, I know the things I know and you know the things you know, and they may be different, but that's okay. It was really hard for me to do that. I think it's a, you know, it's a, this is not the point in 2 Corinthians 10, but the quotation that comes to mind when I say these things is the one in 2 Corinthians 10, which is about those who measure themselves by one another, compare themselves with one another. The way I learned that in the King James, they that measure themselves among themselves and compare themselves among themselves are not wise. The ESV is, but when they measure themselves by one another and compare themselves with one another, they're without understanding. Now, there's a different point going on in 2 Corinthians 10, but there's something in our nature of comparing ourselves with other people that creates a sense of ignorance in us that is true. I don't know what they know. And makes us, you would think would make us humble. You would think would make us interdependent. Oh, I need them because people know what I don't know. But instead, it makes us proud and it makes us reveal our ignorance because we try to act as if we have read everything they've read and we do know everything. Why, of course, I've read all the things you've read. Who wouldn't have done that? That kind of pride is, you know, really unhelpful. And so I began, after a little experience, I began to design everything I did, whether I was teaching a course or going to preach a message or do a series of some kind or another, or when I did 10 years on the radio. I learned to stop trying to pretend that I knew things I didn't know and start just talking about the things I did know. And lo and behold, the things I knew were enough to give me a reason to talk about the things that we needed to cover. And so that was half of the battle. Half the battle was that. The other half of the battle was coming to grips with the reality that I would never know everything. And it is, it's so obvious you're never going to know everything, right? But it's really painful to me that that's the truth. When people ask about the things that I regret or the things that I wish could be different in life, one of my common answers is, I really regret that I'm going to run out of time before I learn all the things that need to be learned. That's painful for me because I can just think of one discipline after another that I want to learn. And, you know, there's no time. There's no possibility of being able to learn them all. And so in all of that wrestling with how do I, you know, stay focused on the road that I have taken instead of the road not taken and so on, I learned to accept this reality that every time I read a book, every time I study a subject matter, every time I learn something, right? So the more I read, and I started saying this to my classes, I started saying it in all the settings where I had an influence, I would say the more I read, the further I see into the bottomless abyss of my dark ignorance. And it sounds cynical, but it's not really cynical. It's just an admission of the truth. No matter how much more you read, the more you learn, the more you realize you'll never know, the more you end up staring into the abyss of your own ignorance. So I say all of that just as a, I know it's a long preface, but I say all of that as a preface to get to something that comes up, and we use this expression from Socrates to make this point, but I want to give the details, the background to it, and I think it's worth sharing today simply for this background in Socratic thought, in Socrates, about knowledge. You've heard the different expressions that he has, and one of the most prominent expressions is that the unexamined life is not worth living. He's famous for having given that expression. I'm not sure we're aware, because most of us haven't read the Apology when Plato writes the Apology of Socrates. It's about when he's accused of misleading the youth in the things that he's teaching as a philosopher, that he's leading them astray from the things that are valuable to the community. And they tell him to stop studying those things and to stop teaching those things and so on. And in his defense, and all of this, of course, does lead to his choice between exile and death, and him choosing death so that he could continue to pursue truth in the afterlife because he believed in something following after. In all of those accounts, the funniest thing about what brings about the trial of Socrates, what brings about his judgment, is this event that transpires that involves the Pythia, which is the sage of Delphi, the oracle of Delphi, and something that the Pythia said, this oracle said. So I'm going to read to you, then I'm going to read to you a little section from the Apology. This is public domain material. You can download it at Gutenberg Press. If you've never looked up Gutenberg Press, lots of classic literature is there if it's no longer copyright protected. And it's a great source of it. But it's the Apology if you ever want to read it. It's fascinating. So anyway, what he says is this in sections 5 and 6. It comes out like this. In his defense, Socrates says, "But, oh, Athenians, do not cry out against me, even though I should seem to you to speak somewhat arrogantly, for the account which I'm going to give you is not my own, but I shall refer to an authority whom you'll deem worthy of credit. For I shall adduce to you the god at Delphi as a witness of my wisdom, if I have any, and of what it is. You doubtless know," and then he mentions a guy's name, Carepho. "He was my associate from youth, and the associate of most of you. You know who he is. He accompanied you in your late exile and returned with you. You know then what kind of man Carepho was, how earnest in whatever he undertook. Having once gone to Delphi, he ventured to make the following inquiry of the oracle." And as I said, Athenians, don't cry out. He's anticipating they're going to say, "You arrogant jerk." And so he says, don't blame me. Don't kill the messenger. "Because he asked," Carepho asked, "if there were anyone wiser than I, Socrates." And the Pythian thereupon answered that there was not one wiser. And you can see why he's worried that they're going to say he's arrogant. And he's saying, "But I didn't say it. Carepho and the Pythia said it. And of this, his brother here will give you proofs, since he himself, Carepho, has already died. Consider then why I mention these things." Now, here's why he gets tried. So here's Socrates being told he's the wisest man. And Socrates wants to at least feign humility. So I don't know exactly where to put this attitude, but this is what he does. So this is where he goes with it. I find this fascinating. I find this a revelation about how people see themselves with each other. So he says, "Consider then why I mention these things. It is because I'm going to show you whence the calumny, these unjust charges against him, the calumny against me arose. For when I heard this, I reasoned thus with myself. What does the god mean? What kind of enigma is this? For I'm not conscious to myself that I am wise, either much or little. What then does he mean by saying I'm the wisest? For assuredly, he does not speak falsely." I mean, he's a prophet, right? "So that he could not do. And for a long time, I was in doubt," Socrates says, "what he meant. Afterward, with considerable difficulty, I had recourse to the following method of searching out his meaning. I went to one of those who have the character of being wise, thinking that there, if anywhere, I should confute the oracle and show in answer to the response that this man is wiser than I, though you affirmed that I was the wisest. Having then examined this man," so he goes into town, he finds someone who has a reputation for being wise. He says, "I'm going to prove that this guy is wiser than I am. So I examined this man, for there's no occasion to mention his name." That doesn't bode well. "I'm not going to bring up his name now, but, I went and talked to him. But you know who he is. He was, however, one of our great politicians, in examining whom I felt as I proceed to describe, O Athenians, So he goes on to say, having fallen into conversation with him, this man appeared to be wise in the opinion of most other men, and especially in his own opinion, though in fact he was not so. I thereupon endeavored to show him that he fancied himself to be wise, but really was not. Now, you can say that neutrally if you want to. You know, so I just decided to help him understand that he wasn't so wise. That sounds great. But, you know, and if you've read Plato writing about Socrates, you know that's what Socrates would have done. He would have asked questions to show the contradictory nature of the man's own answers, right? So he would have humiliated the guy. And so he says, that's what I did. So I wanted to show him that he really was not so wise. Hence, I became odious, both to him and to many others who were present. And when I left him, I reasoned thus with myself. Here's the crux of what we're getting to. I reasoned thus with myself. I am wiser than this man, for neither of us appears to know anything great and good. But he fancies he knows something, although he knows nothing. Whereas I, as I do not know anything, so I do not fancy I do. In this trifling particular, then, I appear to be wiser than he, because I do not fancy I know what I do not know. After that, I went to another who was thought to be wiser than the former and formed the very same opinion. Hence, I became odious to him and to many others. When he goes on to say it in the way that you've heard it expressed in its most powerful way, he's just basically saying, yeah, if I am the wisest of all men, it is because I know just as little as they do, but I also know that I do not know anything. That's the one additional bit of knowledge that he has. He's able to say, and this is the expression that we've given to it, I know that I do not know anything. That one bit of knowledge puts him a step ahead of the other people who think they know something when they don't. By the way, the other half of the Socratic dictum about knowledge is that if you cannot then start studying or examining the things that you don't know, finding where your ignorance is, then there's no point to living. So he goes on to say this, I then remained, and this is in section 17 of that. We were reading section 6 a moment ago. I then remained where they posted me like any other person and encountered the danger of death, but when the deity, as I thought and believed, assigned it as my duty to pass my life in the study of philosophy and examining myself and others, this is what the Pythia is doing by saying, you're the wisest of all men, so you have to pursue philosophy. He says, well, when the Pythia gave me that responsibility in examining myself and others, I should on that occasion, through fear of death or anything else, whatever, desert my post. Strange indeed would it be. And then, in truth, anyone might justly bring me to trial and accuse me of not believing in the gods, from disobeying the oracle, fearing death, thinking myself to be wise when I am not. Perhaps, however, someone will say, can you not, Socrates, when you've gone from us, live a silent and quiet life? Just leave it alone. Let it go. You don't have to be a troublemaker. Live a silent and quiet life. This is the most difficult thing of all to persuade some of you. For I say that would be to disobey God, the deity. And that, therefore, it is impossible for me to live quietly. You would not believe me, thinking I spoke ironically. If, on the other hand, I say that this is the greatest good to man, to discourse daily on virtue and other things which you have heard me discussing, examining both myself and others, but that a life without investigation is not worth living for. That's the statement. The unexamined life is not worth living. Still less would you believe me if I said this. His point is, look, I know I'm upsetting everybody by talking about these things and by studying these things and by confronting people with the things that they don't know or that they don't want to know. But what am I supposed to do? Ignore the fact that God gave me the responsibility of examining my own ignorance and trying to fill the void? And therefore, in my own learning, be able to share that learning with others and for them to grow in their knowledge as well. Now, at the same time, you know, there's a little whininess in it. If what he was saying was, well, do you think I'm not supposed to confront you with the things you don't know? And then why aren't you happy about it? But he's not really telling them to be happy about it. So I'm going to take the whininess out of it and assume there's something mature in the way that he's approaching it. In which case, you just have to say, you know, a John the Baptist is the same thing These are heroes for me, the people who are willing to stand on the other side of the river and say, unless you repent, you will all perish. You are all going to be judged. So make a choice. Do something different. Bring forth works that are just for righteousness, that measure up to the righteousness you're supposed to have, and so on. When I think of a John the Baptist, I think, yeah, that's the way to be. I mean, you're in jail, and the Herod has total power over you. And yet you say, what you're doing is not right, and I'm not going to tell you it's right, regardless of what you want to hear. That just makes me put my arms up and go, yes, somebody's willing to do what they're supposed to do. I love that, and I appreciate it. Now, I bring that up because we all live in ignorance. We all don't know some things. And it doesn't matter how much we know or how much we don't know. We all don't know some things. And we have to grasp the importance of being willing to live in that knowledge of our ignorance, to know that we don't know. Because that's where we grow. That's where we have the opportunity to become different. Part of this came to a head for me in wanting to have this conversation, do an episode on it, because of my thinking about my own issues with racism. We did a panel discussion at Criswell College not too long ago, had a couple of black men and a black woman lead us in a discussion about racial issues and some of the things going on in the African-American community. And it was a really good panel discussion. It was very helpful for me. But it made me, in that conversation, I've had conversations with all of these individuals before, but in that conversation, I realized, I don't think I was seeing this in others. I think I was only seeing it in myself. That's where I pronounced it, at least. I realized that I've lived two different lives, both of which are defined by my ignorance, both defined by what I don't know. In the one life that I'm talking about, I was a white man who didn't know what it's like to be a black man in our culture. And that's without exception. For every white man, that's the truth. I can't describe what it is for every individual in the culture, but I can tell you that a white man in our culture doesn't know what it's like to be a black man in our culture any more than in Thomas Nagel's article, I can know what it's like to be a bat. Someone else's consciousness is different than mine. Their experiences are different than mine. And I can describe and come to understand what I can of it, but I'll never be in their shoes. There's never a point where I can be another person. Just like I can't know what it's like to be a woman in our culture. I can know some things about it, but I can't step into the consciousness of what it's like to have grown up as a woman in evangelical culture or American culture or Southern culture or whatever aspect of it you want to put on it. So one of the lives that I've lived was as a white man who didn't know what it's like to be a black man in our culture. And I'm just putting this in the context of racism because it's one of the areas, most importantly, where I've had to look into the abyss of my ignorance. But in the other life, and this is the more recent one, and I'd say it's a 10-year-old life, and I'm about that mature in it, probably 10 years old. In the other one, the more recent life, I am a white man who knows he doesn't know what it's like to be a black man in our culture. And that changes a lot. Just acknowledging that I don't know the experiences that someone else has within our culture gives me a need to have an empathetic ear, a need to listen to someone else's story and realize that it's different than my story and that the way I analyze the things we do as a society should be different because of the things I don't know. And the things I don't know are made important by the fact that I know I don't know them. Hugely important. The real difference between the two could be put in these terms, and I'll simplify. I mean, I'm not covering every difference, obviously, but an example of the difference between those two lives is that in the former one, the one where I didn't know what it was like to be a black man in our culture, but as a side note, in parentheses, I'm saying, but I didn't know I didn't know it. You know, I wasn't paying attention to that fact. In that life, I said I wasn't a racist. I grew up saying I wasn't a racist. I grew up saying I cared about racial issues. But I laughed at racially charged jokes, not straight up racist. Well, some of them were probably, but a lot of racially charged jokes. I mean, I always thought to myself, well, I mean, I don't mind people laughing at me. There's some truth to that and some falsehood to that. But in some ways, it was the case. But it's not the same. I wasn't in a minority. I mean, I was a white boy becoming a white man in our culture. But I did nothing in that former position of being a person who doesn't know what it's like to be a black man in our culture. I did nothing to notice or respond to the inequalities that were staring me in the face, even though I wasn't paying attention to them. In this latter life, the last 10 years or so, that I've been aware of my ignorance, I acknowledge the racism that still constantly threatens to seep out of, or maybe into, my soul. It's probably both directions. But I don't take lightly anymore the caricatures or stereotypes or tropes or other sweeping generalizations that diminish the way I ought to respect every person I encounter. And that's encountering a person as part of a minority. I'm not pretending I'm colorblind. I know when I'm meeting a black man, I want to meet a black man. But also simply as a person as independent in thinking and value as every other soul, that is, I don't meet a black man and say, oh, now I'm going to get the black opinion on things. I'm going to get a man's opinion on it. And he's a black man's opinion on it. It is a black man's opinion on it. I also recognize the injustice done when any person is pigeonholed only to the degree that they agree or disagree with the tropes that are assigned to a group of which they may very well be a part. That is, when I apply stereotypes to the people that I'm around, regardless, on one side or the other. Wow, that's exceptional. They're not like someone else. This comes out in the phrase that's so, just so inappropriate, that comes out all the time when people say it about someone who, about a black man, when they say, oh, look how articulate he is. They mean it in a perfectly complimentary fashion. You know, look how bright and all of that is carrying forward tropes and stereotypes that would make it as if it's something unusual to have that characteristic. My encounter, my comeuppance, was being slapped in the face with the awareness that I had just ignored those things for so many decades of my life. Have I got it right now? Not even close. Have I solved the problem? I mean, please, there's no solving the problem. But at least I am aware of how many, or at least that there are a limitless number of things about which I'm completely ignorant, that I still just have to learn and learn and learn, and I'll never come to the end of it. So my point in sharing all of this is that I think there are some things that we ought to learn. We ought to understand about why these things are the way they are and why our ignorance is what it is. Like I said, the show is not about racism. It's just about our ignorance, our lack of knowing things, and the importance of knowing that we don't know things. So why don't we know certain things? And, you know, I'm not an expert on this. It's not like I'm a psychologist or trying to figure it out entirely. But I know the things that have confronted me, that have slapped me in the face. And one is a line that I heard in this book by Solzhenitsyn. You know Solzhenitsyn's Gulag Archipelago, and he has another book called In the First Circle. They're fantastic works. They're really long. It's a chore. It's, you know, like War and Peace kind of trudge to get through them sometimes. But, and I'm saying all of that looking across at my producer who read War and Peace in, what, a week or 2 weeks or something absurd like that. Anyway, In the First Circle is one of those novels by Solzhenitsyn, and it's describing the Soviet gulag, the Soviet prison camp system, sort of prison slash work camp system. It's really weird. It's called In the First Circle because there were lots of people who were arrested just so they could have more personnel in these environments where they would work. And there were lots of places, prisons, that were less prisons than they were just factories. And it wasn't really punishment to be there. It was just, we need you to work. And so you're going to continue to work. And you don't have freedom. But, you know, it's not a place where you're being constantly punished. So anyway, they're in the first circle. It's the, you know, it's Dante's first circle of Hades. It's purgatory kind of thing where you're not in the fire, but you're also completely bound in it. And there's no easy escape from it, you know, that kind of thing. So anyway, this is what this line just took me aback when I heard it. Because it was describing this mid-level person in management, in the militaristic political structure of the Soviet Union, who just goes along to get along, you know, and he's just obviously operating in nonsense, making nonsensical decisions in terms of pure reason, but decisions that protect his career and protect his interest. And so the line that Solzhenitsyn creates is this. He says, thinking had always brought him setbacks, whereas zealous subordination had always brought him gain. That line, that's a brilliant line, and it's so accurate. Man, when I think about what's going on in our political parties right now in the United States, there's a lot of this. Thinking, acting independently, you know, using your mind. Thinking had always brought him setbacks, whereas zealous subordination had always brought him gain. That's what we've learned. That's what we saw in Texas. You know, Phelan is not facing a crisis in his position because he had zealous subordination. He was willing to put his neck on the block and say, we're going to submit the articles of impeachment. And now the people who faced the articles of impeachment are trying with all their might to take him down. By the time this airs, they may have taken him down. I don't know. But you get the idea. You just learn to avoid the pain that goes with independent thinking. And where I would put that in the way I have to think about my life, and I don't know where it fits in yours, but would be the sometimes struggle. I'm not sure it's not constant struggle, but at least sometimes struggle between conformity, I'm going to get along, you know, zealous subordination, I want to fit in, don't want to rock the boat. The sometimes struggle between conformity and conviction that comes up, and I think it comes up in every believer's life at some point. It may come up constantly in every believer's life. And I get it. There's a problem when conviction turns to intransigence, that you just don't care about the people around you and you can't even listen and negotiate and you're not willing to compromise on anything and so on. I get that. Intransigence is not what I'm trying to bring up as a goal here. But the awareness that sometimes our ignorance isn't based in a lack of ability to know something or a lack of opportunity to study a discipline or to make hard choices, but rather complacence. You know, he thinking it always brought him setbacks. He didn't want to know certain things, and he didn't want to think about certain things because zealous subordination was the thing that always brought him gain. There is a certain amount of ignorance, a certain amount of knowledge that's sacrificed in our society because we want to be a part of the team that wins. We want to be a part of something we believe in, and it doesn't matter whether it's actually true or not. What matters is that we are capable of believing in it if we can just ignore those other things, and we're more comfortable in the position we're in than in being confronted by the things we don't want to know. So some ignorance, I think, is from complacence. I like the world the way it is. I don't want to think about the way it might be otherwise. These all bleed over into each other, by the way. I could give examples where they do. But I think some ignorance is, and this one seems obvious to me, even at a pop level, some ignorance is psychological. Again, I'm not a psychologist. I'm not a counselor. My producer is. She can correct me on these things if I say something risky. There's not much risky in this, though. Some ignorance is psychological. You know, it's a state of denial. You've been confronted by something. You're aware of it. You know it. And yet it creates a disconnection with the whole way you want to see the world or that you do see the world. And so you live in a state of denial about it. No, it's not the case that they're dead. No, it's not the case that we don't have enough income to live this lifestyle. No, it's not. You know, and you mean it. You believe it. You try to hold that view and you ignore the information that would say otherwise. And it's part of the reason, and this is just one example of where confirmation bias would come in, but it's one of the ways confirmation bias does come into our lives, that you discover information you don't agree with, you know, you flip through that page. Oh, well, there's another person saying, I ought to do this. There's another person saying, I ought to do this. Another person, oh, here's someone who says what I'm doing is just fine. That, look at that. See, I don't have to change my life. And so some ignorance, I think, is psychological. It's just too much for us to deal with. I could give a personal example here, but we're sort of running a little short on time. I'll give a super short personal example. When I discovered that the pastor who had really had a profound influence on me as a mentor had been cheating and stealing and doing some just irregular and immoral things, when I discovered that with my own eyes, I mean, I discovered, I confronted it right up front, him in person, encountered it. I ran to the, and I mean, got in my car and drove immediately to the church and had 30 or 40 minutes of prayer time and just trying to deal with this confrontation in my own consciousness about something that didn't make any sense to me. And then I probably went 2 weeks as if it had never happened, as if I had seen nothing, as if I had encountered nothing. It is, looking back on it, it's the weirdest thing to me that someone else who noticed something was awry had to come to me and say, have you noticed such and such? Before I finally went, oh, man, I forgot all about that. I had lived in a complete state of denial. I think I didn't choose to do that. There was something psychological going on. It was just too big a break in my best understanding of the world at the time. I mean, I was 18 years old, I think. At the time, I was either 18 or 22. It was right before or after I went to college. There were two different episodes, and I can't remember which one it was. Yeah, it was, anyway. So some ignorance is psychological. That's a different matter. I mean, you have to deal with that, and hopefully you can talk to a counselor and get some help on stuff like that. That's fine. Some ignorance is volitional. This is the part that Peter is talking about in 2 Peter. When he talks about those who just don't want to believe in God or his second coming because they don't want to believe that there's going to be a judgment. And so if you don't want there to be a judgment and you do want to live whatever lifestyle you want, then the natural conclusion you come to is, well, there must not be a God who would ever act in this world. And his statement is, so they say, oh, where's the promise of his coming? Since the fathers fell asleep, all things continue as they were from the beginning of creation. And then he says, because they deliberately overlook this fact that the heavens existed long ago and the earth was formed out of water and through water by the word of God, and that by means of these, the world that then existed was deluged with water and perished. It's as if they just ignore the fact that there was a judgment in the past, Noah's Ark. Now, again, I'm making Peter's argument. I'm not saying this is the argument you would use with some evolutionist today, but I'm saying Peter's argument is, you know, these guys who know Judaism, they say, well, God's not ever going to judge the world. And he says, well, what, are they just choosing to ignore the fact that he already judged the world once and that the same God who judged it with water then is able to store it up for judgment by fire in the future? Why wouldn't they know that? And the answer to why they wouldn't want to know it is because they don't want to know it. They don't want to think about where the judgment would be. There is some ignorance. There is some lack of knowledge of things that is simply because we don't want to know it. Man, I've seen this 100 times since I've been in ministry, and it usually has to do because of my own disciplines and the things I'm most involved with, it usually has to do with hermeneutics, where we say, well, hermeneutics demands that you read the Bible this way. But over the decades, I learned that what we really meant was, well, you can't have a hermeneutic like that because it leads to conclusions that I don't agree with already. And it's a mind-blowing choice not to acknowledge things that are on the face of it potentially true. So anyway, there you go. So I think those are some background things that we ought to have in mind. The point I want to make is this about knowledge. I mean, knowledge is not king. It's not like we're trying to be Gnostics. Who your salvation is in your knowledge. We're not saying that at all. But knowledge is right in the center of this whole universe of ideas within which our faith lives and swims. The ideas of belief You cannot know something you do not believe. Belief and knowledge are inherently intertwined. Knowledge is, in its most common and simplistic definition, justified true belief. So when you put all those kinds of things together, you realize that belief and truth and even relationships, which are knowing someone. I mean, that's the language of Scripture, to know someone. Belief and truth and relationships and understanding, wisdom and maturity. Those are all about knowledge. And the first, I'm concluding, I'm just giving you a warning so we don't just fall off the cliff here. It's the first principle in knowledge, the very first step in knowledge, is the paradox introduced by Socrates in his Apology, that we begin to know when we finally admit that we don't.
Thanks for joining us for Coffee with Creamer. Your cup of coffee may be finished, but we are not. Come back next week for a refill as we sit down to examine a new set of ideas and cultural issues. Don't miss an episode. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts or visit our website at barrycreamer.com. Until next time, keep your mug hot and your mind sharp.